Hello, everyone. This is Karen Schoen with American Freedom Watch Radio, and we are brought to you live on bbsradio.com. Before we begin the show, I want to wish all of our Jewish listeners a very happy New Year. And for all of our listeners, today is the Day of Atonement. And what that means is that we must reflect, remember, and ask God for forgiveness for our sins. And as we do that, we pray that God will put all of us in the Book of Life for the next year. So I wish that to all my listeners as we prayed today for forgiveness, which coincides with the Pope being in America, and we will talk about that in a moment. This is the first show that we have on BBS Radio, and I want to thank the staff for making the transition so easy. It is a pleasure to be involved with such wonderful people, and I hope that we will all be successful together, and I hope also that you will learn. My show, American Freedom Watch Radio, has been on the air for approximately 5 years, and it is a direct result of what happened in the Gulf oil spill as we sat back and watched our government do nothing for the last 85 days except destroy the Gulf, the estuaries, and all of the rivers. We then got together with the groups of states around the Gulf, and we started talking about what was going on and what was happening with our government. As we started digging, we began to develop the plan, and I realized at that time that this plan was applicable to just about everything that was happening in America today. So forming a radio show was easy because the goal is truth, education, conversation, and action. It is our goal to bring you truth. It is our goal to point you in the direction where you can be educated, help you in conversation so you can share the message, but most important, come up with a solution that can be applied to the things that are happening to us today. The information and all of the documentation that you will need is found on agenda21today.com. There you will find all the source documents for the things that I will be telling you in our shows, and I will make mention of that throughout the show so that you can go and find the documentation and find the sources for yourself, because that is part of education. If you don't learn it, you don't know it, and you certainly can't understand it. And that has been a big problem that we have had today in our education. I am a former teacher, and once you are a teacher, you never stop teaching. I am also a business owner, and I was involved in the financial and real estate business and have a vast wealth of knowledge in that field as well. It will be my goal every 2 weeks to pinpoint an issue, bring on a guest that we can have an in-depth conversation, and you will be able to walk away with the knowledge and the ability to have that hard conversation and to understand what's happening. The basic plan that our government is working on is nothing new. This has been going on for years and years and years, hundreds, if not thousands of years, have been based on the same goal. Our guest is going to give you an in-depth conversation about the history. I'm going to talk about what's going on presently. The plan that was formulated today is called Agenda 21. And when it first came about in 1992, when it first surfaced, those of us that reported on it got called, you can imagine, every name in the book for trying to scare the American people and show the people that the United Nations is not really what they think it is. It is actually a plan with a group of people. I will call them the regime, because the regime is in both political parties, so I'm not going to choose one party over another. They're both being run by the same group of people. And the plan is Agenda 21. Now, I mentioned the Pope because the Pope is here, and what he's going to be discussing is Agenda 2030, which is the child, the offspring of Agenda 21. Agenda 21 is a United Nations initiative that is approximately 350 pages, 40 chapters of the absolute 100% control over every aspect of human development. Every aspect of humanity is to be governed and controlled by the group that is promoting what they call a new world order with a one world government headed by the United Nations. Let me go over that again. A new world order with a one world government headed by the United Nations. How does that sit with you? Because it certainly did not sit well with me. After reading Agenda 21, I realized that their prime goal and objective is to eliminate private property. Why do they want to do that? Because when you understand their goal and the way that they sell it, which is what they call social justice, redistribution of wealth, when they discuss that goal, what they focus on is land, because in America, land ownership is the most important thing that creates wealth for an individual. Individual ownership of land is something that our founding fathers held almost above everything else, because they realized that ownership is equal to freedom. A man owning his property can create wealth for himself and his family, and that can never, should it ever, be taken away. The United Nations plan is quite different, and I'm actually going to read you a section of the United Nations plan, and this comes right out of the UN Habitat, and this is part of the Agenda 21, which discusses land. And land is something that is unique to all of us. So let's hear what the United Nations says about land. The UN Habitat stated, land, because of its unique nature and crucial role it plays in human settlements, cannot be treated as an ordinary asset controlled by individuals subject to the pressures and inefficiencies of the market. Private land ownership is also a principal instrument of accumulation and concentration of wealth, and therefore contributes to social injustice. If unchecked, it may become a major obstacle in the planning and implementation of development schemes. Social justice, urban renewal and development, the provision of decent dwellings and healthy conditions for people can only be achieved if land is used in the interest of society as a whole. That's it, folks. That's what this is all about. America is an anomaly. Americans are able to own a piece of their country. They physically have a piece of the rock. They physically can have ownership in their person, in their business, and in their land development. This is unacceptable to those who are pushing Agenda 21 and have anything to do with the United Nations. And the way they describe it would be, if I own 5 acres, and you own 10 acres, and your friend owns 20 acres, well, my goodness, that's not fair. And because it's not fair, no one should own anything. Everything should be given to the government, and the government should have it in its power to control the property and determine where the individual can reside. That is totally un-American. The sad part of it is that this is what our children have been learning in school for the last 30 years. And this is why when a man in the street starts walking and talking to people and says, "Who is our vice president?" No answer. Who did we fight the war against the Revolutionary War? Who did we fight? Well, they'll come up with China. Because American history is no longer taught in our public schools. Why is it not taught? It's not taught because this crowd believes that educated people are not going to accept the rules of government, that ignorant people are very easy to control and manipulate. Educated people are not, so therefore the purpose of the school and the school programs is to ensure the fact that Americans are dumb, do not know their heritage, do not know their rights, do not know their constitution, and therefore will stand on a street corner and wave a sign that says, "Yay, communism," rather than fighting for freedom. When a person doesn't know what they are missing, they certainly will not fight for it. So, what is happening in America today? Every single program, every single thing that we're doing, no matter where it is, no matter what it is, every issue, every problem that we face, all comes for the same reasons. The Agenda 21 focuses on money, power, and control. And everything that's happening in America today, you can find its root in those three issues. The other thing that we should remember once we learn these programs is that they are all focused and work exactly the same. A crisis is created. The people will scream for the government to come in and take away the crisis. Everything that we are doing is in crisis mode. The government is to the rescue. The government can help. The government is the only place that we can get our answers, that we can get our resources. The government will help us. Okay. Really, that's not quite the way it works in America. So the plan then becomes, and what we have to understand, is that everything is connected. Nothing happens randomly. Everything has a plan, and every plan is based on a lie with the motivation of money, power, control. Now, if you can remember those things, what we're going to do is be able to look at problems, go back in history, and actually see that there is nothing new under the sun. Everything that's happening has been around before, has been here before, and is just going to recreate itself. Remember, a man that does not know his history is doomed to repeat it. And it is for that reason I have invited as my first guest to join me this evening Bill Federer, a great friend, a fabulous historian. He writes the most incredible books, has a wonderful website, and thank you so much for joining me this evening, Bill. Please tell everyone the names of the books and where they can find them.
Well, my website is AmericanMinute.com, and the books, one is called America's God and Country Encyclopedia of Quotations. That one sold 500,000 copies. It's like a Bartlett's Book of Quotes, only a famous American. Another book is called Change to Chains. It's quite popular. It shows how the most common form of government in all of recorded human history is what? It's kings. They go by different names. Pharaoh, Caesars, Kaiser, Sultan, Tsars, Maharaj, Genghis Khan, Julius Caesar, Attila. The name changes, but the function remains the same. One person ends up with life and death power over everyone in their kingdom. And, of course, I think it goes back to the original fall of man, the story in the book of Genesis, that, you know, know, and man sinned, and selfishness comes into the human DNA, and Cain kills Abel, and one king takes a kingdom from another king. And so you put some babies in a playpen, one of them will take the rattle from the others. You put some kids on a playground, one of them is the bully hogging the ball. Put some people in the woods, one of them is the Indian chief. Put them in the inner city, one of them is a gang leader. And so it's this Lord of the Rings type of thing where everyone wants this ring of power. And, you know, Nimrod, the Tower of Babel, concentrated power. And if you're friends with the king, you're more equal. If you're not friends with the king, you're less equal. And if you're an enemy of the king, you're dead. It's called treason. So for most of world history, the most common form of government was a king. And equality was how close of an orbit can you and your family get to the royal family. And then I
well,
go
don't
through
we really era. Have that going on today, Bill? If we look at who is in power, and we look at what happens to people that disagree with our wonderful president and how they get crushed and destroyed, like what happened with the IRS, this is just a replication of the same issue.
Well, you're connecting dots very well, Karen. And sometimes if all you know is the present, you don't really know what's going to happen next. But if I put a dot on a page and I say, where's the next dot going to be? You're like, I don't know. But if I can show you all the dots preceding that dot, you can put a ruler up next to them and sort of take a pencil and trace it and say, well, the next ones are probably going to be along this line. If all you know is the present, you don't know where you came from, you have no idea to predict. Winston Churchill said, the further back you look, the further forward you are likely to see. You get a trajectory that way. And so you're right that since the most common form of government is a king, what we've experienced in America is a departure from that. But unfortunately, there is this gravitational pull to want to have power concentrate. You know, it was great that Lincoln ended slavery, but in the process, a lot of rights went from the states to the federal government. It was great that Franklin Roosevelt wanted to get us through the Depression, but power concentrates in his New Deal programs, and Lyndon Johnson's society welfare state concentrated power. Nixon's war on drugs and Bush's war on terror, and now the new president, no matter what the crisis is, the answer is let power concentrate. He has his pen and his phone. And so we're moving back in the direction where if you're friends with the president, you get an Obamacare waiver, maybe some Solyndra money. And if you're not a friend of the president, you get your car dealership shut down, your Gibson guitar factory raided. And if you're an enemy of the president, you get audited. And so we're moving back in this direction of a hierarchical system. And it's a change of form of government. And does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense, and that really is what I'm focusing on, is the good news. And the good news is, well, we should read Bill's books, because they're really good, and I love Chain to Change. That was wonderful. But what I learned from that, exactly what you said, is that the name changes, the process doesn't. And all that is happening is that we're adapting the same process and giving it a new name. We're dusting it off and giving it a new name. You know, what got me started on that part was one of the things that Donald Trump said. And I don't want to make this a Trump show. That's not the purpose. But he was talking about the wall in China. And he said, if China can build a 13,000 mile long wall, then we certainly could build one that was 1,000 miles. And I went back and I said, okay, why did the Chinese build this wall? What was the problem? What were they facing? And lo and behold, what do I find? The same problem we're facing today. They were the Muslims with a different name. They were the Huns. So all those years, all that history, we're back in the same place again.
Well, you know, it's interesting that when China built the Great Wall, and they did it in several sections, mostly during the Han Dynasty in the 2nd century A.D., that ended up going into disrepair, and then in the 1300s, the Ming Dynasty built it back to what we see today. But the original wall kept the Huns and the Mongols from invading into China, and so those invading tribes turned west. And it started a domino effect of tribes attacking each other and picking up and moving further west and moving further west, and more tribes picking up and moving west until they spilled over the Roman borders. And so around the 4th century is where you had this flood of illegal immigrants into Rome. They were the Ostrogoths, Visigoths, Anglo-Saxons, Jews, Lombards, Berbers, so forth. They first came slow, and they worked as menial jobs. They would learn the language. They would assimilate. But then they came so fast that they kept their own identity, their own language, their own culture. And they mixed in a little Latin. That's why we call them romantic languages, not because they kissed, but because German, French, Spanish, and so forth have a Latin root to them. But the Roman Empire was being invaded. And so Rome had to put its military around the world to put out these fires. And they had to pay taxes for the military. And so the Romans got in debt. One historian said the tax collector was worse than the barbarians. The Romans had fewer kids, and so they recruited a lot of these immigrants into the military, promising them citizenship if they would serve in the military. And now you got a situation where you got Visigoth soldiers who are given the job to keep other Visigoths out of the kingdom, out of the empire. And, of course, they're like, why are we fighting off my relatives? And so... then
I had that same feeling when Angela Merkel said that the reason why she wanted the refugees to come to Germany is to improve the economy and the population. It's like, wait a minute. On one hand, you're saying the planet is overpopulated and we have to depopulate the planet. And then on the other hand, you're saying the economy of Germany needs more refugees to come in and help with the economy and help improve the population, but don't learn German.
Well, and the dilemma is that most of them sign up for welfare. Clearly half of them do sign up for welfare programs. The pretty predictable pattern, the wife goes down to the welfare office, say my husband's not around, and she gets the welfare checks. And, of course, the husband has his four wives, and he visits them, and the more kids they have, the larger the checks get, and he's living like a king on the government dole, and he's spending his day spreading Islam. They were interviewing the one Muslim leader in England, and they asked Judare, I'm not pronouncing his name right, but the English TV interviewer puts on a little veil out of respect for him, and she said, don't you feel bad that you're living off the English people, yet your goal is to take over? And he said, no, Allah permits us to live off the infidel while we're subduing them. It's a very parasitic attitude, like a parasite will live off the host victim, sucking its blood, but its goal is to eventually kill the host victim.
Exactly.
So we see... and then another book I wrote is called What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran, A History of Islam in the United States. And it brings out a pattern that, you know, when the presidential candidate Ben Carson said that he would not support a Muslim who adhered to Sharia law for president, and the media jumps on Ben Carson. And we have all these experts in the Constitution, but no experts in Islam. And so they say, well, the Constitution does no religious test. The problem is, in Islam, they are a religious system, a political system, and a military system. And as a political military system, it's totalitarian, no different than communism or Nazism. It's an ideological system that controls your lives, your thoughts, your families, your everything. And the key is Muhammad. And that's something that they can never get away from. And Muhammad was the best Muslim that ever lived. His life is called the Sunnah, the way, the example. And Muhammad's life went through three stages. And so Muhammad was a religious leader in the pagan city of Mecca, and he only made 70 converts in 12 years. Then his rich uncle, Abu Talib, dies. He was Muhammad's protector. Nobody... give Muhammad any problems because of his uncle, who was his protector, Abu Talib. Then in the year 619 AD, Muhammad's wife, Khadija, dies. Now, he later goes on to have anywhere from 11 to 22 wives, slave wives, and concubines, but originally he just had one wife, Khadija. She dies in 619 AD. It is his year of sorrows. And so Muhammad ends up getting chased out of town for disturbing the peace, and the pagans chase him out of Mecca. He tries to go to a city called Al-Taif, and the people of Al-Taif don't want Muhammad. They pelt him with stones, they throw rocks at him, they jeer at him, and the little kids chase Muhammad out of town. And so Muhammad is a Muslim refugee. He's not wanted in Mecca. He's not wanted in Al-Taif. And so he goes to Medina. Medina was a Jewish city. Three Jewish tribes controlled Medina, and they were nice. They let Muhammad in as a Muslim refugee, as an immigrant. And he is allowed to go into the minority neighborhoods, where he begins to make a following. We're familiar with the term of organizing in the community, and he gets a following.
Community organizing. Get that following. Get those people to follow you. But remember what Bill said. In order to do that, if you have to lie, that's okay. And that's what went on.
And so Muhammad goes to the Jewish leaders of Medina, and he pressures them to accommodate him politically. And he makes a treaty with them. And so now Muhammad is a political leader in addition to being a religious leader. Then something happens. His followers in Mecca, they get argumentative, confrontational, threatening, very much like some of his followers today. They get chased out of Mecca for disturbing the peace. They are Muslim immigrants. They are Muslim refugees. And they're allowed into the Jewish city of Medina. They gravitated to the neighborhoods where Muhammad is. And Muhammad allows them to rob the caravans headed to Mecca in retaliation for the Meccans chasing them out of town. So where Jesus said, if they take your coat, give them your shirt, Muhammad's attitude was, if they take your house, you retaliate, take their caravan. And so Muhammad gets a whole chapter of the Quran on how to distribute booty from robbing caravans. It's Surah 8, chapter 8. He gets a fifth of the booty. And so the Meccans send 1,000 soldiers to protect and escort their caravan as it goes by Medina. And Muhammad, with 300 warriors, defeats 1,000 at the Battle of Badra, B-A-D-R, Badra, in 624 A.D., This amazing victory, having been outnumbered 3-1, convinces Muhammad to be a military leader. And he goes on to fight in 66 battles and raids in the next 8 years before he dies. So he transitions from a religious leader to a political leader to a military leader. Well, he fights in these battles. He actually goes to Al-Taif. He's hurling catapults into the city, and they're smashing and killing women and children. And they come to Muhammad and they say, well, you know, you're killing innocent people with those catapults. And Muhammad's response was, they are among them. They got to be killed too. And so suicide bombers, ISIS killers today say it's okay to kill innocent people to advance Islam because Muhammad did. And now we're back in the city of Medina. The Meccans send 10,000 soldiers to stop Muhammad. Well, Muhammad's version of roadside bombs and IEDs was he dug potholes and trenches all around the city, which rendered the superior cavalry of the Meccans useless. And then Muhammad goes to some of these pagan tribes at night, bribes them, goes to some of the other pagan tribes at night, threatens them, and they all leave. And it gets freezing cold for a week. The rest of the Meccans retreat. And so within this situation where there's nobody else left to come to the rescue of the Jews. And so Muhammad gets offended at one of the Jewish tribes, confiscates their property, chases them out of town. Gets offended at the second Jewish tribe, confiscates their property, chases them out of town. And then finally he does the third Jewish tribe, he chops off their heads, 600 or 700 of them. So within 5 years of Muhammad coming into the Jewish city of Medina as a refugee, as an immigrant, there's not a Jew left in the city of Medina. They've been chased out, killed, or enslaved. And so this process is in the very DNA of Islam itself, because it's Muhammad's example. And what's this example? You go into a host country as a refugee. You gravitate together and form communities. The imam comes and says you need to start following the Quran closer. And the ladies start wearing the burqas. The burqas have the same psychological effect on non-Muslims as gang colors. And so the non-Muslims see their neighborhood changing, and they move out. More Muslims move in. And those that refuse to move out, that's when there's Muslim youth that do random violence. And that no Muslim family will witness against another Muslim family on behalf of some kafir infidel. And so there's no witnesses to these crimes, and eventually all the non-Muslims move out of the neighborhood. And so we see this process where the first ones come in as immigrants, then they increase the number of their followers, they gravitate together, they form their communities, and then they demand political accommodation, and then they eliminate the previous culture, house by house, neighborhood by neighborhood, city by city, until they've taken over. And this is the way it transitions from the Dar al-Harb to the Dar al-Islam, the house of war to the house of Islam. So Islam is a religion of peace. They think that there will be peace when the whole world submits to Allah and becomes Muslim. There's a quote from Lincoln where he said, "We all declare for liberty, but in using the same word, we do not all mean the same thing. We all want peace, but our definition of the word peace is different than their definition. Our definition of peace is different groups getting along. Their definition of peace is when the whole world submits to the will of Allah." And the word Islam means submission, and a Muslim is one who has submitted. And so, again, we see this pattern that goes all the way back to Muhammad.
Nothing has changed. That's how I started out the show. Everything is the same. Nothing changes. Now, if we could go back a drop, Obama made a very, very, very big claim that the Muslims had a lot to do with American history. So I went back and I started looking to what the Muslims had to do with American history, and I discovered that if it were not for the Muslims, then we would not have a navy. Why could I say that? Because the Barbary pirates who were raiding all of the ships as they were coming to the New World with all of their goodies were Muslims. The Muslims were infiltrating and doing exactly the same thing that you just described, Bill, except they were doing it on the open seas. And at that point, Jefferson, who got a Quran to study, that's the whole key, Bill, because this is not taught in our schools anymore. Our history does not discuss this at all. Our children have no idea of the danger, nor do the people, of the danger that they're in. And when we see city after city in America, like what just happened a couple of weeks ago in Texas, a mayor had to go after councilmen because they wanted to impose Sharia in the community. Can you explain Sharia?
Oh, right. Now, this is a very important topic. Ben Carson said he would not support a Muslim who for president, and he goes on to explain, a Muslim who follows Sharia. Sharia is the Islamic law. The Islamic law goes back again to Muhammad. So there are Muslims who believe that Muhammad got laws directly from his Allah. And since these came directly from his Allah, they consider them divine and superior to every man-made law. And so Muhammad's law says that a man can have four wives, as many extra women as his right hand possesses. He can beat his wives. He can marry as young as 6 years old, because Muhammad's youngest wife, Aisha, was 6 years old. All he has to do to divorce a wife is simply say, "I divorce you." She's out the door. She can't even go back in and get her clothes. She definitely does not get any alimony, or never see her kids again. And in Sharia law, it's where a woman's mind is deficient, and so it takes two women to testify in court against one man. A woman gets half the inheritance that a man gets. In Sharia law, if a woman is a victim of rape, it's her fault because she allowed herself to be used as a tool of Satan to tempt the man. So not only does she get raped, she gets whipped 100 times because she was a victim of rape. This is Sharia law. This came from Allah to Muhammad. And so we see that this conflicts with our form of government, where you don't punish the victim of the crime. Another is Muhammad's law says to cut off the hand of a thief. In our country, we have a constitution with an amendments. One is the Eighth Amendment that says there shall be no cruel and unusual punishment. Anyone in America would think it would be cruel and unusual to cut off the hand of a thief. And so we see a conflict. We have a First Amendment that allows you freedom of religion. And so you can join a faith. You can leave a faith. Islam has the RIDDA laws, R-I-D-D-A, the apostasy laws. And it says that if you're free to join Islam, but if you leave, it is the death penalty. And that goes all the way back to Muhammad. And so the situation that the fundamental Muslims cannot get away from is that if they believe Muhammad was the perfect Muslim and his life is the sunnah, the way, the example, they're going to forever have this gravitational pull to want to go back to the laws that he got from his Allah. Now, there are Muslims that have backslidden and they don't try to follow these laws. There are Muslims who are trying to reform Islam, trying to say, well, yes, Muhammad got these, but the laws were just for that particular time in history. They're not forever for everyone else. I applaud these reformers. The problem is they're not getting any traction with the media or the country or the president, so forth. But we see that as long as Muhammad is considered the perfect Muslim, it's going to be this continual pull for people to follow his example and to follow these laws that he got from his Allah. Now, another situation in Islam is called taqiyya. It means sacred lying, holy deceit. You're actually obligated to lie to infidels to advance Islam. A couple stories. Muhammad had a warrior who was captured, and he was forced to renounce Muhammad. He escaped and came back to Muhammad. And Muhammad forgave him and said, if they make you turn, turn, but don't turn in your heart. In other words, it's okay to deny Muhammad in a pinch to save your skin as long as you don't fight against Islam. In other words, it's okay to say you're not a Muslim in order to get elected, but then everything you do once you're elected is to help advance Islam. The only way to know if somebody has left Islam genuinely is if they fight against Islam and they're trying to expose what they had formerly been a part of. And so just their words saying, oh, I'm not part of that, I'm a different kind of Muslim, their words are not proof. It has to be their actions where they actually risk their lives to try to stop the Sharia Muslims. That's the only way you know is if they have genuinely left that. Another story.
Just wanted to interject one thing because this goes back to our president. We have a huge controversy with all of the candidates because eventually they're all going to be put on the spot as to defending whether or not Obama is a Muslim. Based on what you're saying, he's allowed to lie. But based on the history of Islam, in the Jewish religion, the mother dictates the religion of the child. In the Muslim religion, the father dictates the religion of the children. And both Obama's father and stepfather were Muslim. So one would then assume that unless he wants to die for leaving the religion, and based on his actions of promoting Islam on a continual basis, I would have to say, yes, he is a Muslim.
Yeah, actions speak louder than words. So ignore what he says. Just look at his actions. He surrounded himself with staffers who embrace the caliphate. The caliphate is the Islamic State. So the supreme leader after Muhammad died is the caliph. The area he controls is the caliphate. And so long list of names. One is Arif Ali Khan was the deputy mayor of Los Angeles. He stopped Los Angeles from tracking terrorists, did such a good job, he got chosen to be a key member of Homeland Security. Kareem Shore is a devout Muslim from Damascus. He is a key member of Homeland Security. Dalia Moggahed is the first veiled Muslim woman advisor to the president. She said Sharia law is misunderstood. It's actually gender justice. So, ladies, if you want your wife to, your husband to beat you, you know. Rashad Hussein has the whole Quran memorized, and he's called the Hafiz, and he is the Deputy Associate White House Counsel, and he said the president is educator-in-chief to America on Islam. That was the Weekly Standard. He puts somebody in charge of Homeland Security, Jeb Johnson, who said his job is to stand up for the plight of Muslims. He tells the head of NASA that instead of trying to land people on the moon again, that his job is to reach out to the Muslim countries and help them feel better and so forth. And we see also Hillary Clinton's right-hand person, Huma Abedin. She has connections with the Muslim Brotherhood. And with her help, Hillary rebuilt mosques in 27 countries as a cultural outreach. Didn't rebuild synagogues, didn't rebuild churches, rebuilt mosques using taxpayer money for this. And then we see Hillary. It meets with the OIC, Organization of Islamic Cooperation. These are the richest Muslim leaders in the world, the 57 Muslim countries. And they had a meeting in Istanbul, so it's called the Istanbul Process. Hillary meets with them as Secretary of State. She promises to help them, what? To achieve their goal of stopping the blasphemy of Islam. And it was a resolution for the UN, 1618. And some definitions are important. The gospel insults Islam. Saying that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel insults Islam. As a matter of fact, everything that's not Islam insults Islam. So in other words, when they say they want to stop people from insulting Islam, what they're saying is they want the whole world to submit to Islam and convert or be a dhimmi status. And so Hillary promises them, and the internet's filled full of all these quotes where they're commending her on her promises to help them do what? Stop the insulting of Islam. Short time later, Hillary allows the troops and security to be pulled out of Benghazi, and then our ambassador's killed the very next day. She says, it's these people that insulted Islam. We got to stop people from insulting Islam, this video insulting Islam. And lo and behold, Susan Rice comes out and says, well, it's these people insulting Islam. The president says, these people, you know, the future does not belong to those who insult the prophet. And then all of it, and then it comes out, it had nothing to do with that video. That this was a planned attack. And now it's coming out. It was a planned attack with American weapons. That Hillary's actually supplied the weapons to the Muslims that did the killing at Benghazi. Now we're finding out most of these emails that Hillary had, it was a gun running operation. That yes. The president on his own took out Gaddafi in Libya, very similar to the way he took out Mubarak in Egypt. Why? Because he wants to get rid of all these leaders so they can set up the caliphate, the one world Islamic state, so to speak. And so he uses our military assets to get rid of Gaddafi in Libya, and he's moving the guns from Libya through the port of Benghazi, and they're putting them on ships, their inventory lists of RPGs and rockets and guns, and they're going to ports in Turkey and in Syria, and it describes the name of the ship, the size of the ship, the ports they go to, because they're not the busy ports. They're the ones that weren't quite as busy, so they weren't being watched as much. They're unloading these guns, and they're giving them to the Muslim Brotherhood people so they can take out Assad in Syria, because they want to get rid of all these kings and presidents so they can have their Islamic state. And so when Russia comes to Assad's rescue, these Muslim Brotherhood people, armed with American guns, driving American Humvees, go into Syria and Iraq and kill the Christians and these minorities. And they went to a special training camp in Jordan, and we trained them. And then Obama lets five Muslim generals go from Guantanamo Bay in exchange for a defector so they could go over and lead these people. And then it comes out that they're doing these atrocities. We rush through Congress funding with right. John McCain, right? Funding to train Muslims, to fight Muslims. As soon as they get armed and trained, they join ISIS. We are either the most inept world superpower arming the bad guys, or this is intentional.
Well, I believe it's intentional, and I'll go on the record and say that one. One of the things that you can clear up for our listeners as well is the conflict in Syria. Now, Assad may not be a good guy, and I may not love him, and I may not think he's great and wonderful, but one of the things that he has done is kill lots and lots of ISIS leaders and ISIS people. But I believe until the Sunnis and the Shiites can come together, ISIS will never be stopped, because that's the real conflict. So if you could explain the difference between the Sunnis and the Shiites, that would be terrific. Because we are, they want to arm Iran so that they can fight ISIS, but they'll wind up fighting anybody else as well. We'll wind up again with the proverbial egg on our faces.
Yeah, they're, in their mind, the caliphate is a done deal. It's just who's going to run the caliphate. And they're knocking off Egypt, knocking off Libya. They want to knock off Syria. It's going to come down to Turkey and Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia is behind Turkey. It's going to come down to Turkey, Saudi Arabia versus Iran. Iran is mostly Shiite. The others are Sunni. Goes all the way back to Muhammad. Muhammad had a daughter named Fatima. She was married to Ali. And so their followers are called Shi'ali or Shiite. 10% of Muslims are Shiite, mostly in Iran. Fatima and Ali had a couple sons. One was murdered, another one was poisoned, and it was done by the Sunnis. And so the hatred began. There are 12 male descendants of the Fatima-Ali marriage, and the 12th imam, the 12th leader, blood descendant of Muhammad, was shoved in a well, and they think he's going to come back and usher in the end of the world. And that when he has the total world chaos and crises, then Christ will return. But their version of Christ is different than the Bible version of Christ. Their version of Christ is he's going to come back and kill all the Christians and kill all the Jews and kill all the apes and kill all the pigs. So their version of Christ is the biblical version of the Antichrist. So Muhammad had a father-in-law. He actually had several father-in-laws because he ended up having lots and lots of wives. Well, his youngest wife, Aisha, was 6 years old when he married her, 9 years old when he consummated it. Aisha's father was Abu Bakr. Abu Bakr was a general who fought with Muhammad in all of his battles. And so when Muhammad died, Abu Bakr claimed to be the one who knew Muhammad's way, and the word Sunnah or Sunni means the way, and Muhammad's life is the way. And so Abu Bakr said, I was with Muhammad, I know the way, and he claimed to be the first caliph, the first supreme leader in Islam after Muhammad. And his followers are called the Sunnis, and 90% of Muslims are Sunnis, and they're scattered all around the world. And so the fighting between the Sunnis and the Shiites are basically fighting between the followers of the father-in-law versus the followers of the son-in-law. It's a family thing, sort of an infighting. I mean, we're talking lots of power in this family, and the one caliph is murdered, another one's poisoned, another one's, you know, stabbed, and they buried him in the very clothes he was murdered in because they wanted to do it at night in a hurry. But I mean, it reads sort of like the Cosa Nostra or the Mafia. I mean, these rightly guided caliphs are all meet untimely deaths. And anyway, so that's the origin. Now, they keep the hate alive. So in Iran, they have an annual event called Ashura. And the Muslim men with their little boys get together in the square, and they take knives and hit themselves on the forehead so that blood comes down their face. They'll take a knife and hit their little bitty son on the forehead until the blood comes down their face. And they get together in the square, and they rock back and forth, and they moan and cry for the murder of Hussein, the son of Fatima and Ali. And they whip themselves into this frenzy, and they weep and cry and moan because they want to keep that hatred of the Sunnis alive. So this is different than, you know, the biblical admonition to forgive and to go on with your life. No, they want to keep that hatred alive. And anyway, so 90% of Muslims are Sunni, and they're scattered around the world. 10% of Muslims are Shiite, mostly in Iran.
And that is really the source of the problem, folks. It is a family feud that the world is getting sucked up into. And until the family stops feuding, this is not going to stop anytime soon. So does America really belong in the middle of this feud? I don't think so. Because, you know what, I believe the problem is, Bill, without understanding the history, it's another fight. But when you understand the history and how back and deep it is, well, it becomes similar to the reason why they hate the Jews so much. This is not a new thing. This is a 5,000-year-old thing. They've been trying to eliminate the Jews for about 4,000 or 5,000 years. So the history that's missing from our schools that shows what this is all about, that takes religion. I remember when I was a teacher and we taught religion. We taught the Jewish religion, the Muslim religion, the Christian religion. But we taught it as religion.
I don't know, but I'll pay for it.
Right. Now what's happening in the schools is the Jewish and the Christian part is being eliminated in modern history. What's there in the modern history, if your child reads the modern history textbook from Hoof Mifflin, please make sure you correct those chapters and make sure you correct those pages. There are 36 pages on the glories of Islam, 2 paragraphs on Judaism, and 3 paragraphs on Christianity, culminating in your children writing a pledge to Allah as their only true God.
Right. The Muslims, the wealthy Saudis, have bought good ownership interest in the textbook companies. And so they have rewritten these textbooks. This Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, one of the 19 richest men in the world, he's the nephew of the King of Saudi Arabia. He's the one who donates money to Harvard and Yale so they can set up schools of Islamic study. And so these universities are like, yeah, we'll take your millions of dollars. Sure, you want to have a school? Yeah. And so his idea is you do jihad through money. He bought an interest in Fox News in 2005. And so from that point on, Fox News covers the topic of Islam with kid gloves, where before they had Glenn Beck, who would be like, you know, just bringing on the people who have left Islam and interviewing them and having them tell their horror stories and so forth. And so this Prince Al-Walid bin Talal and these others have bought these interests in the textbook companies. And it's important to understand a couple things. One, there is a communist tactic called deconstruction, where you unhook a train car from one engine before you can hook it on another. It's sort of a sales technique. If I'm a toothpaste salesman, I first say negative things about the toothpaste you're currently using. It'll dry up your gums, it'll rot your teeth, and ooh, you're repulsed by it. And so then you get into this neutral where you're sort of open-minded. Well, what are all the kind of toothpaste out there nowadays? And then I can give you my pitch for this new tartar-controlled breath freshener stuff, right? So it's a detached from what you formerly had affinity for. You get into this neutral where you're open-minded, and then they give you their pitch and pressure. And so they do this with kids in schools. They first say, okay, the founding fathers of America, they were all slave owners. They were chauvinists. They treated the Indians terrible. And the kids are like, ooh, I'm repulsed by them. And then you get these kids into this neutral. Well, gee, we're sort of open-minded now. What are all the kind of police out in the world nowadays? And then you can give them your pitch for this LGBT, gay agenda, transgendered Islamic agenda. And so it's a very similar. Years ago, I talked with Dr. James Dobson, and we were discussing stem cell research and how they would take a cell from your fat tissue, muscle tissue, skin tissue, and they would isolate it. And it's called an undifferentiated cell. So this is a brand new cell that was just created. And they take it and isolate it in a dish. And then they bait it with hormones. And they turn it into a nerve cell or an eye cell or whatever. And, implant it in your body. And so he said, children are the stem cells of the next generation. They take these
kids and their parents.
They isolate them. And then they bait them with the hormones to turn them into whatever kind of kid they want for the future.
Well, Bill, I can't thank you enough, and I can't believe that the time has gone by so quickly, so I'm going to request from you another interview and bring you back so that we can discuss this further, because it's so important for people to understand that when words are said, often they have different meanings to different groups of people, and we have to investigate, we have to know history, So everyone, please go to AmericanMinute.com, sign up and get Bill's wonderful newsletters. Go and read some of his books and share that information with everyone. But now when you hear Dr. Carson say no, if he celebrates Islam, he cannot be the president because that is against the Constitution, you'll understand that Dr. Carson is correct. If another person says, but Obama is a Muslim, well, his father was a Muslim, and in the Muslim religion, he's a Muslim. So that person is correct. Thank you for joining me this evening. Bill, it has been wonderful as always, and I can't thank you enough for all of the research that you have done, saving me mountains of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. It's always an honor.
Folks, you are listening to American Freedom Watch Radio, brought to you live on bbsradio.com. Please join us. Please visit our websites, agenda21today.com, karenshone.com, and our Facebook page, Facebook American Freedom Watch Radio. Have a wonderful 2 weeks, and we will see you again in 2 weeks with another in-depth conversation to make our history understandable. Thank you all for joining me. God bless you all, and God bless America.